The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Welcome to IMC. For those of you who were not here last Monday, I gave a talk on Nibbana, the Pali word for Nirvana, talking about how this important experience in Nirvana, how it works and fits into our Buddhist tradition. And there is a small little phrase that's sometimes used as a kind of a saying, that Nirvana is happiness, and Nirvana is the highest happiness, or the greatest happiness. That somehow the experience of freedom that comes with deeply going into this path of meditation leads to one of the highest kinds of happinesses a human being can experience. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this and talk about it in a little unusual way. Many of you are familiar that it's often said that the core teachings of Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths are truths about suffering. So the first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. The second is a noble truth of the arising of suffering. The third is a noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. For some people, this is the great news, the good news of Buddhism, because it implies or indicates that whatever suffering we have, whatever stress, whatever burden, whatever sense of personal oppression, whatever inner psychological suffering, angst, despair, discouragement that we're experiencing, that it's not permanent. It's there because of things coming together, causes and conditions. And as those causes and conditions shift, then that suffering can cease. And the second noble truth is sometimes defined as the total, complete, without any leftover, complete destruction, cessation, relinquishment, letting go of suffering. So that's kind of nice, though some people find it a little bit depressing that the central teaching of Buddhism talks about suffering. Some people find it very inspiring. Some people come and hear talks on the Four Noble Truths and say, finally, someone's saying it as it is. Finally, someone's not avoiding the truth, what's happening, that they're suffering in this world. Someone's addressing it directly, naming it, and trying to find a way through it without trying to make the world a pretty place or be kind of romantic about how wonderful everything is and basically that you're supposed to just put a smile on your face and kind of go through life happily and something like that. But there's another, I'd like to present this, maybe the Four Noble Truths in a different way, kind of almost like the opposite way. Maybe it needs a slightly different title. And so for now, I'll just call it the Four Magnanimous Truths, or the Four Wonderful Truths, or the Four Thriving Truths. The truths of thriving, and they have to do with happiness. Happiness sometimes presented as the opposite of suffering. So the first noble truth is a noble truth of happiness. The second is the noble truth of the cessation of happiness. The third is the noble truth of the arising of happiness, and the fourth is the way leading to the arising of happiness. And partly it's important to talk this way because it's very easy to miss the message from the Buddha that this path of practice that we're on is meant to be a happy path. And it's a path that leads to a great happiness. The Buddha, one of the titles of the Buddha, was he was called the Happy One. And it was often pointed out in the ancient world that the disciples of the Buddha, the monastic disciples, seemed always happy, always smiling, so always happy. And these were the people who were insisting that there's suffering in the world. So rather than this insistence to recognize suffering, the world being depressing, it did, for the followers of the Buddha, it was actually something that liberated them and made them quite happy in a wonderful way. And I would say in a realistic way. So we have these now four magnanimous truths about happiness. And so then we can go and talk about each of them, define each of them. And so the magnanimous truth of happiness is that gladness is happiness, virtue is happiness, contentment is happiness, joy is happiness, happiness is happiness, samadhi is happiness, truth is happiness, generosity is happiness, renunciation is happiness, release is happiness, disentanglement is happiness. In short, the path of practice is happiness. The path of practice to the end of suffering is happiness. As maybe not initially, because many people come to Buddhism because of their suffering and their challenges and that they have. Sometimes I don't want to belittle or make light of the fact that people come to practice with tremendous suffering sometimes. Horrible things happen to people and people have to deal with. And that's often the case. But at some point, sitting with that and addressing that, working with it, practicing with it, it begins to crack open. And through that crack comes light, the light of happiness. Through that crack comes another thing, comes peace, a sense of well-being. And for me, I sat and meditated probably for, I don't know how many years, but I probably sat and meditated for about 4 years with not really feeling any happiness, but certainly sitting with a lot of my suffering, but having a lot of confidence that this was the right thing to do. And I was pulled into it more and more to really be engaged in this process of really being with what was going on for me and work, and I wouldn't say working through it, but I didn't have any concept of working through it. I just knew that this was true, this was important. I had to show up for this and just be with it. And then probably after about 4 years, there started to be a crack in that. And that crack slowly opened and grew bigger and bigger. And for a long time, I had no idea that the path of practice could be a happy one, and that happiness and well-being, in a sense, could be an important part of this. I got no support for that from my teachers, the people I practiced with. There was no really understanding of that. Or in the Zen practice that I practiced in, there was a kind of a stoicism or a kind of a seriousness about the practice that it kind of like you had to, if you were really a sincere student, you were just serious. And so there was not a lot of bubbling up of joy and happiness around me. So I didn't have any models for anything. But it kind of cracked open more and more, and slowly over time, I began to feel this is actually important. This is something to pay attention to and appreciate. And one of the reasons to pay attention to the happiness that comes along is that happiness can be a teacher. Suffering is a teacher. We can learn a lot about ourselves by sitting with our suffering and looking at it honestly. We can see the causes of it, the underlying conditions for it. We can find a way to let go of those conditions and causes and find a better way to live. But the same way, happiness can be a teacher. Happiness also sometimes can show us the underlying conditions and causes of our suffering. Happiness can sometimes provide a different vantage point to see the same thing, sometimes with more clarity. But happiness also can show us the causes and conditions for happiness, where this well-being comes in, beneficial, wholesome, healthy states of mind, healthy states of heart can come from. And that is certainly part of what Buddhism is about. The Buddha talked about developing, increasing, growing, and thriving in wholesome states of mind. in healthy states of mind. And I think, you know, this word thriving, to thrive, not just kind of like, you know, suffer better, and not just simply, you know, be over your suffering and then live a kind of dull life, but a life that's really thriving, really kind of the best qualities of heart, the best of what we have inside, can kind of bubble up and fill us in this wonderful, alive, nourishing way. And that for me, that as this crack of my armor, crack of my suffering, my crack of my fear and my guilt that I lived with, when I started to crack open, and I really kind of started getting into the practice more and more, it felt deeply nourishing for me. It was like nourishment. I felt nourished. It was amazing sometimes the feeling that I would have of like somehow a flow of nourishment, almost like medicine, kind of flowing through my veins, moving through my marrow, my bones, just the thoroughness and the fullness, the embodiedness of this sense of well-being that came was quite remarkable. And I had never experienced anything like this in my ordinary life. No one had ever told me that there could be such a fully embodied somatic experience of well-being kind of coursing through everywhere and just kind of filling me and delighting me and just feeling so like health was happening, deep health. And it was even more surprising for me to have that because I wasn't looking for it. I didn't even know it was possible. Like, wow, what's going on here? So the first, this magnanimous truth is to recognize that there is happiness in the world and that the Buddhist path involves many kinds of happinesses. It's remarkable to read carefully through the Buddha's teachings and to really see it laid out, all the different ways that happiness, joy, gladness, delight, contentment are emphasized as part of the path of liberation. It was almost the expectation that these kinds of wonderful states would be part of our path to work through suffering, to contend with suffering, to deal with suffering. That the path to the end of suffering is actually a happy path, believe it or not. But maybe not the first 4 years or first while we get started. So that's the first magnanimous truth. The second magnanimous truth is the cessation of happiness. And there's a lot of parallels between the Four Noble Truths and the Four Magnanimous Truths. But one of the places where they differ is that the Four Noble Truths, the second one is this is the arising of suffering, but the second of the magnanimous truths is a cessation of happiness. Happiness is not permanent, usually. And one of the things that happens in life when we suffer, if we were happy to begin with, we lose it. Happiness can disappear easily. And it can disappear for many reasons. It can disappear because the conditions change. If we're happy because one day we won the lottery, and that's where we think happiness is from, and then the next day we don't, and the next day we don't, and the next day we don't, and there can be a lot of misery. And the lottery is not just the real lottery, but it's a metaphor for, somehow cause and conditions, luck, fortune, something comes our way, and we get something wonderful that happens, and then we don't. This is what comes to my mind as I'm speaking. When I was about 8, I think, I really wanted a battery-powered toy that existed back in ancient times. And I really wanted it, and I got it for Christmas. And I played with it once. I was happy, and I never played with it again. I don't think my parents didn't really want to give me this present, but I really wanted it. And so I got it. One day of happiness. I wasn't unhappy, but just that somehow the happiness of having that dissipated so quickly, the promise, the allure, the wonderfulness of what all of advertisement or whatever just didn't hold up, and just after a day it was gone. Another year, around that time, I also got a battery-powered, I don't know if it was a remote-controlled airplane. I think it was back then. It was an airplane on a very long string. But still, you can control it on that string. So it wasn't radio-operated, I think. And so I was pretty happy to get that, pretty good. But it was a little complicated, I guess, for it to work or something, run it, operate it. So my father went with me to the local high school athletic field, and he was going to, you know, show me how it works and make it work. I think it did one half circle around the field, and it crashed and broke, and it never got fixed. So happinesses come and they go. For some reasons, we get what we want, and they don't really make us happy. Sometimes we get what we want, and conditions change, and falls apart, and gets destroyed. And there's so many different ways in which happiness, the things we hold on to, we want for happiness, don't sustain themselves. The world doesn't cooperate, doesn't keep things just the way it's supposed to be. Someone we love gets sick and maybe dies, and our happiness is kind of dependent on them, maybe. Or all kinds of things can happen. People lose their jobs, and suddenly the world is turned upside down. So all kinds of things can happen. In this four magnanimous truths, there are the cessation of happiness described in the same way as the arising of suffering. The cessation of happiness is craving for sense pleasure and comfort, craving for identity and craving for non-identity. The definition of the cause, the conditions for the arising of suffering, is craving for sense pleasure and comfort, craving for identity, and craving for non-identity. This idea of this craving, this thirsting, this wanting of things, is both a source of holding on, a source that makes us suffer, and also can destroy the happiness we have. We can hold on to happiness, and somehow it's so brittle and temporary, so many of things, we can't depend on it. And so if we're holding on for dear life and we depend so much on it, things go awry. This idea of identity, holding on to some kind of person we have to be. We have to be a smart person, a pretty person, a capable person, a successful person, something. A powerful person, a high-status person, or non-identity, trying not to be something. So many people hide who they think they are. They try to pretend they're not something, and they put on clothes that somehow hides their who they are, or they do something with their hair, or I know people who do things with their skin color because they think some skin color is better than other skin color. Some people hide their place of birth, the nationality, where they come from, because it's embarrassing. Some people don't want to let others know that they grew up poor, or, you know, it goes on and on, the kind of things people we hide from other people, because we think somehow we're not going to be liked, we're going to be rejected, that people are not going to look up to us. And this idea of identity, of what we want to become and be and hold on to, is a source of a lot of suffering for human beings. And so it destroys happiness just as much as it brings about suffering. So there's a lot of lists in Buddhism about the things that are the cause for suffering. They can just equally be called the cause for the cessation of suffering, for the destroying the suffering. They kind of go together. If you're happy and you get involved in these kinds of clingings and attachments, the suffering tends to be to vanish. If you're not happy, but you cling to those things, you probably suffer also. And then the third magnanimous truth is a truth of the arising of happiness. And this also is worded like the third noble truth, but then here it's not the cessation of something, but the arising. It's defined almost the same way that the cessation of suffering is described. The remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. So here, the very thing that involves a cessation of craving, that is a cause of suffering, is also the cause, is the ending of that craving, is the source of happiness and well-being. There's many things that bring happiness. The path of practice in Buddhism is one of the very important ones. But that the happiness of doing practice is also a temporary happiness. It's conditional. It's conditioned upon doing these practices. If your happiness is from being generous, generosity is a great source of happiness, and you stop being generous, you know, you still have to remember what you did, and it's nice, but you don't get fed again the same way. The happiness of concentration, happiness of meditation, you've got to keep doing the meditation to benefit from that kind of happiness. So the path of practice is a kind of happiness that you need to do things in order to keep it going. It's possible to stop practice and have a lot of the benefits, a lot of momentum of happiness and well-being of practice, kind of to fade away. And I've known people who've left the practice, their happiness is well-being, their peace has faded away. And after a while they say, my life is not working anymore. And they go back to practice, but sometimes it takes many years to realize that. There's a lot of happinesses which are temporary, but Buddhism focuses on a kind of happiness that's not meant to be temporary, something that's portable, we carry with us, is not dependent on the conditions around us. And that happiness is the happiness of once and for all ending, stopping, uprooting some of the underlying causes for suffering. And the craving that's considered to be the cause of suffering, there's many kinds of craving, but these cravings, these attachments, can come to an end. This is not something which is temporary. It's possible to uproot it. And the example that's sometimes given is, in fact, taking a plant and pulling it up by its roots. And for some plants, if you do that, they'll never grow again. Or another example they gave in the ancient texts is taking a palm tree. If you cut a palm tree at the base, it doesn't, like a redwood tree will sprout from the sides, from the roots. But a palm tree, if you cut it at the base, nothing will grow again. It dies. So cutting our attachments at the base, uprooting them. This idea that really you don't have to kind of diminish them, you don't have to just come to terms with them, be wise by them. You can actually do a radical transformation of the mind, a turning of the mind, uprooting of the mind, so that some of these underlying tendencies that cause us to be attached, cause us to be clinging to things, cause us to be caught up in fear, caught up in identity, just vanishes. It's a remarkable thing to watch these go. I don't know of anybody who they all go all at once, but they do go bit by bit, piece by piece. Remember many years ago, this woman came to a retreat, practiced, came back to a year later to the next retreat, and she said, what happened at the last retreat was that after that retreat, I've no longer been cynical. My cynicism is done. I thought that was pretty cool. Wow. Done. Uprooted. Finished. Being cynical. I thought that was pretty good. So this uprooting of stuff, being finished. Sometimes it's a gradual uprooting. I was neurotically concerned with everyone liking me when I was younger. And I started seeing how painful that was to live that way. And I knew that this was something that didn't make sense, wasn't possible, wasn't looking anymore to be successful, to get everyone to like me. I just wanted to be free of this strong urge for that. And I found myself, that was very hard to kind of even face and admit to myself this was the case. And I could, yes, this is what I have to let go of. But I actually felt afraid of letting go of it because it was a kind of a protection or kind of a hope that I wouldn't have to face the world somehow in starkly naked way or defenseless way or something. And so what happened was that slowly over time, it started to fade and fade and fade. And now I think it's pretty much gone. And so maybe it's still there a little bit, but you know, it's not really a problem for me, and I don't feel it troubles me at all. So that, you know, to look for a magic moment or a pill that's in practice that's going to do it is not always realistic. But it is sometimes more realistic to think that some of these things through practice slowly, slowly diminish to a point where they come to an end. The ending of these cravings, the ending of something that doesn't come back, that's not temporary. That's permanent. And so as these cravings, these clings, attachments cease, completely cease, and then they're not going to come back, then we have a portable happiness, a sense of well-being. Then the well-being, the happiness of not having those challenges, something we carry with us, and the happiness is close by. Maybe not felt every moment, but it's available and there and to be connected to. The third of these magnanimous truths is the way leading to the arising of happiness. And this is exactly the same as the explanation for the fourth of the noble truths of suffering, the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And that is the Noble Eightfold Path. That there are eight practices, healthy practices, that move us towards the end of suffering and conversely help us to grow and develop in happiness. These are eight conditions for happiness. That right view, right attitude, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. It's kind of a mouthful to hear all of them, or earful to hear all of them all at once. But the important things are these practices that are nourishing, nurturing, that are supportive, that help us to thrive, that help something really beautiful begin coursing through us and developing. These are not rote duty. They just do these things as a kind of a duty. They're actually meant to be something that is enlivening inside, that gives birth to something inside that wants to come out and express itself. That health, our system wants to be healthy. Our heart, our psychological heart, wants to flow freely and be unburdened, unrestricted, unoppressed. It wants to sing. It wants to just be open and available and not held down. There's a natural movement towards psychological health. If we get out of the way, the Eightfold Path are practices that are kind of getting out of the way for these beautiful qualities inside of us to thrive. The Buddha said that when someone has become spiritually mature, they don't, I'm paraphrasing him a little bit, when they become spiritually mature, it isn't that they practice the Eightfold Path, they become these eight practices. It's just naturally how they live their lives. So in terms of the middle three that have to do with ethics, it isn't that they have to work hard at right speech, right action, following the precepts, the ethics. They are ethical. They become ethical. It's kind of like who they are as opposed to what they try to do. It's not a rule to follow. It's a expression from the inside to allow. I like to think of it as an artist maybe, expresses herself on the canvas. A dancer expresses himself in the dance. A spiritually mature Buddhist expresses themselves in the same kind of expressive way. Something inside it wants to come out through the Eightfold Path. So for the four magnanimous truths, or the four truths of thriving, the magnanimous truth of suffering, the magnanimous truth of magnanimous truth of happiness, the magnanimous truth of the cessation of happiness, the losing of happiness, the magnanimous truth of the arising of happiness, and the magnanimous truth of the way leading to the arising of happiness. So take your pick. The four noble truths or the four magnanimous truths. There may be two sides of the same coin. So those are my thoughts. So what are your thoughts? What do you think of that? And do you have any questions or any inspirations hearing this or ideas do you want to share?
So you said that you start off and happiness fades over time, which I'm sure we all happiness will cease the second magnanimous truth,
yes.
Right? Which I'm sure we've all experienced. But then theoretically, at some point, that kind of stops happening if you've successfully gone down the path far enough.
If your happiness is dependent on unreliable things, that you can't keep your happiness.
Okay, but if you are...
But you find something reliable, and the most reliable is the kind of happiness that's there when you no longer crave. When there's no longer clinging and wanting and needing something to be a certain way. But if we're always needing things to be a certain way, to have certain things, to receive praise, to get things in the world, trying to organize the world so for us to be happy, sooner or later it's probably going to change. You lose it. But what is it? What's a reliable happiness is kind of the focus of this kind of whole approach. What's reliable? And it turns out, it's a little bit hard to appreciate, it turns out if we can really let go of our attachments, then our happiness then is no longer dependent on what we're attached to, because there's, you know, those things. So it's not fragile. As the world comes and goes and changes in all kinds of ways, we're not depending on it being any certain way. So our happiness is not dependent on it. And we don't suffer if things change in ordinary and psychological ways. But it turns out that a heart which doesn't cling and doesn't grasp, is just kind of like, it's just naturally happy. It's the nature of the heart to be buoyant and open and happy. Except when it's weighed down by things, or closed down, or constricted. And why that is, I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you, because I thought at first it sounded like you were contradicting yourself, but it sounds to me now that, like, you're saying there's different kinds of happiness, or they come from different causes.
Right. Yeah, so there's there's happiness that comes from clinging and attachments, which is, as things in the world change, which they inevitably do, or you change, you die, and so much for your happiness. But when things change, that the world's unreliable in many ways. To hold on to independence is always going to be that way. And I'm sure there's things that are happening in our society, but even now, that many people were depending on it being a certain way, and it's not the way it is, not the way we depended on it. I thought it was really amazing when I was in Burma. So I was living in Burma on retreat, meditating, and all I was doing was meditating, all my waking hours. But every once in a while, we got little news that we had to know from the locals. They told us, you should know this is happening. And one day they said, you should know this, that all currency, paper currency, below something like $10 is no longer valid. Now, most people had their money under their mattresses, and most of them had it in bills less than $10, because this is Burma, And so they wanted to kind of somehow eradicate. The government had this problem with all this black market money and all this people who are not putting money in their bank, not paying taxes. I don't know what they did. So the solution was just to invalidate paper currency. I said, wow. In our paper in the United States, it says, in God we trust. You can do that with money? I thought money was money. I thought it was like inviolable. I thought you had to be a certain way. I was flabbergasted. I thought you could rely on that. So we'll wake up tomorrow morning, and who knows what's going to happen? Something will change. So let me see. I was going to say. But the other kind of happiness, there are healthy happinesses to have. There are happinesses that don't come from clinging, but they can also be temporary. And that's what I was trying to say about the happinesses of practice. There's a lot of happiness that come with practice, but it depends on the practice. If you cling to that and it goes away, then it's, the suffering is even worse. But you don't have to cling. You don't have to feel suffering if you don't have that happiness. But you can lose the happiness. But the happiness that comes from destroying craving or clinging, that can't be taken away from you because it's gone. Does that make a little more sense?
Yes, thank you.
Here, can you...
I appreciate that you flipped the figure-ground relationship with this magnanimous set of truths. I guess just what was coming up for me is I've often heard, for example, Ajahn Chah, suffering is rote burn, don't cling, or you'll suffer. And this really points to the joy of letting go.
The joy of letting go. And that's it's kind of an art form, almost, to learn how wonderful it is to not cling, to let go. There's certainly the well-being, the goodness of feeling the release of that tight hope holding on, the cramping that can happen in the mind and the heart, just always holding on the tightness and the constriction. It just feels so good just to have it released. But there's also the wonderfulness of just that openness, that freedom, that ease that can come. And the more we let go, the more ease and peace there can be inside. And that's just happy to go through the world, and that ease, that peace. The peace of not clinging. It's a fantastic thing. It's like one of the greatest treasures. If you want to be wealthy, find this inner peace. I think of this, I don't know if I can say this properly, but the story of you know, this man is spending his days sitting by the river fishing, and another businessman comes along and says, you should really get a fishing boat and really go out and you can catch a lot more fish. Well, why should I do that, says the man who's fishing. Well, if you have a fishing boat and then catch a lot of fish, you can buy two or three fishing boats and hire people and have a big fishing company. But why should I do that? Because you can keep growing the business and have lots of, you know, whole fleet of big things and start having fishing boats that you in headquarters in many different countries, and it'll be a great empire and you'll be the greatest, you know, fishing merchant in the whole country. Well, why should I do that? Because then when you retire, you'll have lots of money and you can just go to the river and fish. So why not just fish now? So I don't know how that story kind of, you know. So, you know, let's get a lot of good cars, a big house, a big fat job. Let's get, you know, the best this and the best that, and get it, all these conditions, everything, all the comfort things, all the things in place and right. You know, it's been years building it up. And then we can finally relax and let go. And really let go, because we can just let go into our luxury, into how wonderful it is in our mansion and palace and our cars. And we sit down, we finally arrived, we're retired, it's so good. And someone says, you know, this house has 82 rooms, and I figured that it takes about, you know, one day, you know, we should clean one room a day, because it takes about 80 days for the rooms to get dirty again. So we'll go around, you know, and clean all the rooms, or, you know, take care of all our palaces, you know, all our things, you know, and or something. What about just letting go? We not have so many things. So there's a story of Mullah Nasruddin, this wonderful wise man of Persia. And every day he eats beans and rice. And he has a neighbor who's a minister for the king, and who lives in a palace and is wealthy, and his neighbor says, "Mula, you know, you don't have to eat beans and rice. If you just kind of kiss up to the king, then and flatter him and stuff like that, then you can, you know, he'll shower you with wealth and you can have all kinds of food and have a wonderful life." And Mula says to his neighbor, "If you were just happy with rice and beans, you wouldn't have to kiss up to the king." So, you know, you're happy, you know. So this idea of letting go and finding happiness, there's so much happiness that's available in this world that's really there for easy picking. That's invisible if we're constantly wanting more, having this, having that, trying to build and build and build a safety and a nest and this and all kinds of things. So one of the forms of happiness in this list of happiness in the first magnanimous truth is that renunciation is happiness. Renunciation, letting go. Inner well-being is the greatest happiness, the greatest treasure, the greatest wealth. To really learn to identify this inner wealth, treasure that we have of peace, of ease, of love, of warmth, of happiness that can live inside, and really see that that can be our home, that we're not dependent on getting more things and getting and doing and all this stuff, and to learn wisely, in a smart way, how to live a life of simplicity so that there's lots of time and ability for this inner treasure to be there to inform us, to be with us, and to guide us. It is possible. This world, it's possible to live a very happy life. And it's very sad to see, walk around society and see how many people seem to not know this. That they don't really understand it. They're chasing empty dreams. So there is a path. There are these four magnanimous truths. They can be your truths. May you be happy. So, thank you.